The TypeScript ends here. You've been listening to 21, The Final Unfinished Voyage of Jack Aubrey, by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull and directed by Kathleen Gormley. Included with this book is the following afterword by Richard Snow. The other day, I heard Patrick O'Brien receive about as high a compliment as a writer can get. An old friend of mine, a professor of history and literature, had just read Master and Commander again for the first time in a decade. "How well it holds up," he exclaimed. "It's amazing. That first meeting, it's like," he waved his hand as he searched for a comparison, "it's like Prince Hal meeting Falstaff." The meeting, of course, takes place between Lieutenant, for just a few more hours, Aubrey, and a weedy-looking little physician named Maturin. It was a contentious meeting and might well have led swiftly to the death of one of the two, most likely the young naval officer. Instead, of course, it led to the greatest friendship of modern literature and ushered millions of 20th-century citizens into a world warmed and clouded by sea-coal fire, rationalized and tormented by the architects of the Enlightenment, fed salvers of steaming offal, washed down with suicidal quantities of claret and port, and defended by hundreds of close-packed seaborne towns whose elders' grasp of mathematics, physics, ballistics, and meteorology was all that stood between the residents and extinction. My friend who made the Shakespeare comparison, Frederick Smoller, had come early to this harsh, seductive world, back when its creators' books were struggling to find an audience in the United States. Lippincott, Stein and Day, Master and Commander, Post-Captain HMS Surprise, the publishers tried and withdrew, after Desolation Island, permanently. Or so it seemed. During the years of drought, Patrick O'Brien's acolytes did what they could to keep Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin in their lives. They opened accounts at the great English bookstore Hatchard's. They wrote to booksellers in Canada. The most fortunate of them acquired, along with the precious novels, a correspondence with the lively and generous-spirited Richard Allard, O'Brien's English editor, and himself a formidably accomplished historian and a superb writer. Another friend of mine, the journalist Mark Horowitz, who would later publish an influential profile of Patrick O'Brien in the New York Times Magazine, had left New York to become a belligerently loyal Angeleno, and sent Fred and me messages saying that every bookshop in Los Angeles stocked imported O'Brien novels. And how do you like that, you haughty Manhattanites? Surely this can't have been entirely true. And yet Mark always seemed to have read the latest one before we did. In the meantime, of course, we proselytized with the predictable success. Them, I've read all the Hornblower novels, and that's enough for me. Us, but that's like saying, I've read Robinson Crusoe, so there's no reason for me to look at Dickens. Such harangues often ended with an indulgent smirk from the victim. And why not? If this writer was really all that good, everybody would know about him, right? It's a fair question, and eventually Starling Lawrence answered it. He is the editor-in-chief of W.W. Norton and Company, and in 1990, O'Brien's agent, Vivian Green, pressed a copy of The Reverse of the Medal on him as he was leaving London bound for New York. By the time he disembarked at JFK, he had been won over. He would bring out the next O'Brien, the letter of Mark. This was a courageous decision. The series had already failed here, and it is considerably more costly to publish a writer than it is to pester your friends about him at a dinner party. But it turned out to be the right time. All those scattered little enclaves glowing with O'Brien enthusiasm were ready to reach combustion. The resulting blaze created rather than destroyed. So far, it has cooked up 5 million copies and an admirable motion picture that will continue to spread the word for years to come. That the movie became the object of some prissy reproach for not more fully unfurling the characters of Stephen and Jack only ratifies the power of the books that gave it birth. This American enthusiasm sent ripples back across the Atlantic. On a visit to London in the mid-1990s, I was gratified to see that O'Brien's novels had been moved out of naval fiction, a bookstore section we alas don't have over here, across the aisle into literature. So, in a very short time, everybody finally did know about Patrick O'Brien, to a degree that when he visited our shores, he attracted a following of a dedication and willingness to travel great distances to be in the presence that seems to me equaled only by that of the Grateful Dead or the Rolling Stones. And like Mick Jagger, he never disappointed. What writer since Hemingway, and perhaps Fitzgerald, has looked so thoroughly the way you'd want him to? Clean-shaven, slim, slightly below middle height, but giving the impression of that wiry strength more often found in novels than on the speaker's podium, and with the affect of bemusement that was, I think, a sort of courtesy to soften the impact of those daunting eyebrows and the comprehension, wit, and occasionally caustic scorn that flicked from him unceasingly. And then he was gone. Gone not merely from New York and Los Angeles and Seattle and all the other cities where people of high consequence were now wild to get him to their dinner parties, but from the world. And yet, as the surprising volume you have listened to reminds us, he is not gone at all. When death took Patrick O'Brien, this book had not been given a name. It had advanced only 3 chapters, 63 handwritten pages, most of which had been typed and given preliminary corrections by O'Brien. I say preliminary because there are, here and there, a few repetitions that this most scrupulous of writers would not have permitted himself. O'Brien in holograph offers advantages and drawbacks. I find his handwriting both exquisite and difficult to read, but persevering through it offers the pleasures of a wonderful bloodless duel that Stephen engineers and a casual sketch of a seating arrangement that has the electrifying effect of making the principals seem entirely like living people. 21 is a fragment, of course, and one would expect such a document to be little more than a forlorn remnant. After all, O'Brien had been composing it during a melancholy time. His wife, Mary, had died. He was alone. He was 85 years old, and his newfound fame had brought his life under media scrutiny that would have dismayed people far less protective of their privacy than he. But just look at 21. There is no sense of harassment or desolation here, no loss of focus, nor of energy. And if it ends too soon, it is nonetheless a rich distillation, a summary of sorts, of all that has, over thousands of pages and tens of thousands of miles, won O'Brien such passionate admirers. First of all, there is the language. And here I mean not O'Brien's prose, but what he gives his characters to say. He insisted that their speech was an accurate reflection of how early 19th century people talked. But I believe it is a brilliant poetic invention, complex yet so wholly consistent that we in time learn to speak it almost through the same process we would follow acquiring a foreign language. It never ceases to show us that this is a world at once remote and familiar, and the conveying of that familiarity is, I think, a feat of the imagination that far surpasses, say, J.R.R. Tolkien's kingdoms of dwarfs and sorcerers. We get to be introduced to Jack and Stephen one last time, and how keen the pleasure remains. Stephen, abashed in the composition of his heavily coated love letter. Jack, with elephantine, ignorant delicacy, discussing the Church of Rome with his closest friend. And here is Killick, his insolence for once extinguished by the calamity that has befallen Jack's best uniform during freezing weeks off the Horn. Now come the curiously stirring details. The men begging slush from the galley to give the shot in the garlands a pleasing sheen. Stephen clipping the tip of his pen with a minute pair of metal jaws made for the purpose. To be sure, there's no battle in these pages, but the great gun exercise on the Sussex gives a highly satisfactory sense of the violence and power that men like Jack Aubrey controlled. And any disappointment at the lack of a frigate duel must be eradicated by the presence of the humor that quietly leavens every paragraph. Jack, explaining how he acquired the extra gunpowder necessary for his spectacular exercise, says he'd bribed the last powder boy for a trifle of whiskey. You know the Irish drink, Stephen, I am sure. I have never heard of it, says Stephen. This tiny exchange is marvelously appealing. Both men are being funny. Both men understand one another perfectly. Their amity suggests what I find so moving about this last work from Patrick O'Brien's hand. Some of the novels end with their principals settled and content, some with them in poverty and peril. It is, of course, impossible to say where 21 would have left them. I'm sure the egregious Captain Miller would have reappeared to work some malice after Stephen's humiliation of him, and Jack's money-making initiatives would likely have put him on the metaphorical lee shore. Right now, however, we are able to visit these friends we have followed so very far in a rare state of almost perfect felicity. Jack has seen his black son ably discharging important duties. Sophie and his daughters are with him. Bridget is with her father. She's thriving. And Stephen is with a woman who is very dear to him. Jack is flying a rear admiral's flag aboard a ship of the line, so we can leave them sailing through fair, sweet days. Stephen with his dissections, Jack with his sacred blue flag, Killick muttering darkly over the toasted cheese, embarked on a voyage like the one that opens the book. Quietly indeed they sailed along, with gentle breezes that wafted them generally northwards at something in the nature of 5 miles in the hour, northwards to even warmer seas. Little activity was called for, apart from the nice adjustment of the sails, and although the exact routine of the ship was never relaxed, nor her very strict rules of cleanliness, these long sunny days, with the soldier's wind, seemed to many the ideal of a seaman's life. Regular, steady, traditional meals, with the exact allowance of grog. Hornpipes in the last dog watch, the deep melody of the doctor's cello from the cabin, and the cheerful sound of the gunroom's dinner. The future lost in a haze somewhere north of the equator. Remember that this was written at a time when the author was lonely and tormented. Yet Patrick O'Brien has given a farewell to his followers that is as gracious as it is gallant. And we, in turn, may find some solace in the thought that of all people, this man would not have hated to be taken out of action, much as Nelson was, deep in triumph, shedding glory on the service he loved, and still at the peak of his powers. This ends Richard Snow's afterword to 21, the final unfinished voyage of Jack Aubrey, ending the Aubrey Maturin series by Patrick O'Brien. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends A Rage for Glory, The Life of Commodore Stephen Decatur, by James Tertius Decay, narrated by John McDonough. Stephen Decatur was one of the most awe-inspiring officers of the entire age of the Fighting Sail. In this, the first new biography of Decatur in almost 70 years, James Tertius Decay, one of America's foremost naval historians, recounts Decatur's life in vivid colors. Drawing on material unavailable to previous biographers, he traces the origins of Decatur's fierce patriotism, chronicles Decatur's passionate love affair with Susan Wheeler, and provides new details of Decatur's tragic death in a senseless duel of honor, secretly instigated by the backroom machinations of jealous fellow officers determined to ruin him. Only a handful of Americans since his time have ever come close to matching his extraordinary glamour and brilliance. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalog, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.